evening. This is Thursday Night Talk. I'm Danielle Orr, and our guest tonight is Dr. Mary Gelinas. We will talk for a bit and then open the phone lines for you to call in with questions or comments. That number is 826-4805, 1-800-640-5911. How might we improve our interactions at home, at work, and in our communities? We all have different degrees of concern about different issues. How might we learn to listen as well as speak across and through that which divides us so that together we can take on the challenges facing us today, even if there are lions and tigers and bears in the room or the meeting? How can we learn to calm and manage our brains' reactive survival instincts? How can we stay connected to compassionate nature that resides in all of us? These are some of the topics covered in Dr. Mary Gelinas' new book, Talk Matters. Dr. Gelinas is a business leader, community member, consultant, educator, process designer, and facilitator. She's the co-director of Cascadia Center for Leadership, along with her partner, Dr. Roger James. And her lifelong pursuit of how and not why has garnered her a more nuanced understanding of how deceptively simple yet truly difficult it is to converse effectively across the boundaries of age and ethnicity, experience, titles, class, and ideology. She invites the reader in this new book to consider a notion of enlightened self-interest and offers emerging neuroscience to guide us through so that we may stay more connected and harmonious. Mary is an associate of the Community Democracy Workshop, a national project of Philanthropy Northwest. With her partner, Dr. Roger James, she has developed pioneering and transformative approaches to leading, creating change, planning, and solving complex problems. You have an opportunity to take Leading Organization and Community Change, a program through HSU. It's a certificate program. It'll be offered in the fall. You can register at HSU through Extended Ed or at Cascadia through Humboldt Area Foundation or CascadiaLeadership.org for that certificate program. The book comes out in August. It's her life work. She's sharing it for all of us. It's not just a book, it's a real book. It's a big book, and it has a lot of interesting topics in it. So tonight, on Thursday Night Talk, Talk Matters, Dr. Mary Gelinas. I'm Danielle Orr, this is KHSU. Michael Roccaforte is our engineer today. Hi, Michael, and we'll be taking your calls a little while, in a little bit. So, Mary, hi.
Hi, Danielle.
So let's talk about interacting more effectively. We'll skip the why and go straight to how. Let's start with why does process matter?
What's intriguing to me is that when I work with organizations or community groups or in public processes, I will often hear people say, I'm not a process person. And what I try to very gently but clearly say, it's all process. What they don't understand is they're often engaged in a process that is not effective. It's not designed appropriately or implemented appropriately. So it's sort of a willy-nilly, you know, we jump into the discussion without understanding what the purpose of the discussion is. We don't understand what people's roles are, what the decision-making process is. So that is a process. And process affects how we interact with one another. It affects our ability to think and create and work together collaboratively. Poorly designed or implemented processes can bring out the worst in people. You know, if I think about, for example, how we hold, you know, public hearings, you know, which is kind of an oxymoron because it's really not much hearing going on. You know, people have to walk and go stand in front of a microphone looking up at decision makers who are up on a dais. All of that can bring out the worst in people because it triggers the threat mechanisms in the brain. So people can go into easily fight or flight behavior. I mean, I know many of our elected officials, you know, see people come and talk to them and they can take on a very combative tone. And it's not necessarily that they are combative, but if they're frightened, they get angry. I mean, that fear and anger.
It's the first thing that comes up.
It's the first thing that fear and anger are like kissing cousins.
Survival.
You know? Yeah, it's survival.
Kissing cousins. Oh, I like that.
So it's interesting. I mean, just the size of tables at meetings, you know, for example, it'll have 10 people, 10 or 8 or 10 people.
And that's part of the process.
And that's all part of the process.
Who knew?
Who knew? Exactly.
You did.
I do.
Well, and so basically you need to read this book to know what the process is. But, I mean, that's the case for most of the world. You don't have the right size table, and it's boom, 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 2 minutes. So,
well, and pace. In the Western culture, our pace of conversation is oftentimes inhumane. And the pace alone can evoke defensive behaviors from people. I mean, I'll just tell you a quick story. Several years ago, I was involved in an international women's dialogue project that was part of the MIT Sloan School of Management. So I was in this dialogue with about 30 women from around the world. It was just prior to when Nelson Mandela was released from prison. So I was in this room with both black South Africans and white South Africans. One of them happened to be Sheila Zuzulu, who was the daughter of Walter Zuzulu, who was one of the main players in the African National Congress. To make a long experience very short, there was one particular woman in that group, Noma Temba Luhabe was her name. And the majority of the women in that room were white and were from the West. You know, a lot of Europeans, a lot of Americans, some South Americans. And what we all had in common is how quickly we talked. Mm. You know, it was like watching a ping pong ball going back and forth in the room.
Same cultural education.
Same. So Noma Temba at one point with her just gorgeous big brown eyes kind of looked around the room and kind of looked at us so quizzically and said, "I don't understand how you can talk so fast. For me to understand what someone else is saying, I have to let it in through my ears, through my eyes, down my throat, through my whole torso, into my belly. And that's when I understand. Mm-hmm. And it's only then that I can respond." It was such a moment for me just to both see a difference in culture, of course, but to more deeply appreciate how the pace of our conversation can alienate us mm-hmm. from one another.
Yeah.
And when we feel alienated, our connection to one another is connected to our survival instincts. I mean, that was the key step in the development of the mammalian brain. Our survival and sense of safety is now connected to our sense of connection to one another. So when we feel isolated, we don't have access to our full brain, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy for us to go into more defensive behaviors,
mm-hmm.
you know, fight, flight, freeze, yeah. et cetera.
Well, and that makes me think in an hour meeting, if you're trying to get a lot of stuff done, it's hard to really hear people and really have enough time for process. It's really a time-consuming matter.
Well, it's interesting. My belief and my experience over these many decades of both, you know, facilitating and being participant in meetings and helping leaders design meetings, you know, facilitating them myself, you know, in groups large and small, you know, a group of 4 to 400, that there's an expression that came from old colleagues of mine, and it's go slow to go fast, meaning that if we take the time to not only listen to one another, but to be clear inside ourselves what we really feel and think and what we want to say in what I call an inclusive way, that we can move faster because we can get to ideas faster. People don't get threatened, so they have full access to their brains. Mm. So I have a sense that when we slow things down, my experience is we often are much more effective. We don't have to do a lot of rework. Conflicts aren't as prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
It's a paradox.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, it is. So when we take time to slow down and stay connected to one another as human beings, really amazing things can happen. But that's not really the norm. The norm is what you suggest, an hour-long meeting. We got to do X, Y, and Z and get out of here and go on to the next meeting.
Mm-hmm. And so tell the listeners how you came to care about how so much and process. What was that about for you?
Well, I went as an undergraduate at Northeastern University in Boston. It's a cooperative university, so every other quarter I was out working. So I worked actually as a newspaper reporter. So I was training to be a journalist. And two things happened at that time. One is when I would cover stories, you know, like a school board meeting or, you know, something going on in, you know, some local business, whatever the content was, I would notice how people were making decisions that affected other people that they had no say in. That was really interesting to me.
It was. Mm.
And the second thing is, and I'm going back years now. I was 19 years old, and I was on the first, this will tell you how old I am, I was on the first run of the Amtrak train from Boston to Washington, D.C., and I was on this train with Governor Volpe of Massachusetts, right? And he had just named some grand poobah to some court in Massachusetts. See, I don't even remember the content,
okay.
Right?
Yeah, it's a long time ago.
So when I was talking with him, I mean, here I am, this total innocent, 19 years old, talking with the governor. And I remember my questions to him were all about how he made the decision. I mean, I missed the scoop. My editor at the Brockton Enterprise was so angry with me because I had missed the scoop on who he had appointed. Because I was really interested in his thought process, how he made the decision, what criteria he had used, who he had involved in the conversation with him. I didn't understand that that was a whole field of study, and it wasn't until I got to college. Well, graduate school, really. Later years in college and then on to graduate school. There was a whole field called organizational development, the behavioral sciences, that really were studying that very question of how things happen in interactions with people.
So this is truly your life's work.
It is my life's work.
And you go over a lot of really interesting topics in the book. How about talking about communicating ineffectively or destructively? Do you want to say something about that part? How your brain reacts in a certain way and then fireworks.
Fireworks, yes, exactly.
That's for everybody all the time.
Well, it is actually.
Default.
Here's an interesting thing that I think is part of let me say a couple things. One is some of the behaviors that we don't realize are destructive really are, like interrupting another person, judging not only what the person says, but the person themselves, which is a lot of a fallacy in logic. It's called arguing ad hominem. So, you know, you attack a person, which may or may not have anything to do with what the person said. You're just trying to undermine their credibility as a human being.
That's destructive.
It is very destructive. Another way that people speak is they'll speak as if they are speaking the only truth that could possibly be considered. I mean, I have the right answer. And even if they don't say it out loud, we can hold fixed and critical views of one another, which the other person feels. They sense it. They resonate with it, even though they don't know it consciously. So those are some of the ways we can be destructive. So the impact on the other people, either individually or in a group, are that there are several things that can get threatened, but I'll just there are several aspects, but I'll just go to the essence of it, which is that it threatens our sense of survival. I mean, even though, as you said, in the opening, there are no lions, tigers, or bears.
There are, though, in your head. Yeah.
There are in our head. There's a vestigial, not a vestigial, how would I say? It's a habitual part of the brain that because the brain evolved to keep us alive, It is very attuned to any sense of threat to our well-being. So even though we're not, our physical survival is not being threatened, we can still feel threatened from the behaviors I just mentioned, being interrupted, criticized, and so on. When that happens, several things get evoked in the body. And here's an important aspect. When those things get evoked in the body, our emotions start to trigger before we are conscious, before we are aware of them. Which means that we often say and do things outside of our control. We lose a kind of awareness, and we go on automatic. I mean, can you remember times when, I mean, I do,
sure,
when I've thrown an absolute hissy fit, right? And there are things coming out of my mouth, and it's like, oh, my God, who is saying those things?
Well, in your body, you can feel it in your
body.
And
you can feel it in your body.
You feel in your body something is happening.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. And then everyone goes to a different place, I guess, but
so it can those kind of destructive communication behaviors can really evoke not so good behavior on other people's part, even though we can act very civilized, but inside we might feel quite frightened and angry,
well,
if we express it or not, it's going on.
And acting civilized doesn't exactly mean anything, actually. After you read this book, I mean, civilized is—it's a term for, you know, etiquette, I guess. But I mean, really, to be in control of yourself and know all these things going on—that's more civilized than just,
yeah,
being civilized. And you go over a lot of the brain activity and the different stages in the brain. So you talk about this in the book too. You don't just.
Right.
Tell us, hey, it's in your brain and you can shift it. There's in-depth coverage on the brain in your book.
Yeah, there is. Because for me, one of those most, it's really magical right now what we're learning about the brain. To me, it's just like, I get so excited I can barely sit still. That over the last 20 to 30 years, because the technology changed, we can now watch the brain in a very different way than we ever could before. And so what I find very hopeful, and I'll focus on a particular part of the research, which is that what we're discovering, and I name the researchers and, you know, give you in the book, you know, you can find more about it. I also have a blog, so you can also read some of this on the blog. Is that we're now discovering that when people have some sort of contemplative practice where they're learning to use their mind, I mean, I hope this makes sense, to use their mind to watch their brains or to watch the sensations in the body, to go back to what you said about the impact of emotions on our physiology. What the research is showing us, I think, are three very important things. One is the more we are aware, internally aware, of what's going on inside us in a non-judgmental way, moment to moment, it opens up the possibility that we can make conscious choices about how to handle our emotions. So in a way, contemplative practice is enabling us to develop inside ourselves something that nature actually didn't give us, which is the ability to be conscious of emotions before they overwhelm us and drive our behavior. So it gives us the possibility of conscious choice. And the second is that the contemplative practice enables through, you've probably heard of neuroplasticity, right? I mean, for generations, people thought the brain was fixed. We now know that through our experience and our thoughts, we can reshape our brain, its functions, its neural pathways. So what we're discovering through contemplative practice is that the brain is actually less reactive. So we're less likely to get triggered when we feel threatened.
Yeah.
And we notice it faster.
You're more relaxed.
Well, it's not only relaxed. We're more relaxed and we're more aware. Literally, the amygdala, which is in the mammalian part of the brain, which is kind of the alarm bell in the brain, is less reactive in the brain.
Mm-hmm. Let me just say, you're listening to Dr. Mary Gelinas. She has a new book, Talk Matters. It's 7:20, and you're listening to KHSU. Please, Mary, go ahead.
Yeah, and the last thing I wanted to say about the research, and this comes out of the work of Richie Davidson, primarily at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, is that, and there are others, but I think he's been leading the charge primarily, is that we can, through a certain form of meditative practice, actually strengthen our empathy and compassion for other people. So even though it is, as you mentioned earlier, part of our nature, it's fascinating tug of war in our heads between protecting ourselves or connecting with others through empathy and compassion. Both of them are survival strategies, and the contemplative practice enables us to choose and practice more the connective side of ourselves mm-hmm. versus the protective side of us, especially when it's not needed and not helpful.
Yeah. And so you're bringing the notion of contemplative practice to business and meetings. And so do you teach people how to do that when you're in your courses that you're teaching? You go over it in the book, too.
Yeah, I do. In the courses, we talk about the brain. Mm-hmm. We talk about contemplative practice. Mm-hmm. We actually do some meditative practice. I, you know, expose people to different forms of meditation because mm-hmm. not everyone wants to sit on a cushion and meditate. You know, there are other ways to develop our brain so that we're mindful moment mm-hmm. to moment mm-hmm. and have the positive impacts that I just mentioned. You know, like, for example, Roger Golf's. I mean, that's his meditative practice.
Yeah. Were you aware of meditative practices when you were younger?
No. No, I was drawn to meditate. It's interesting. I actually started meditating way before I learned about any of this other great stuff that was going on in the field of brain science. Because I work as a teacher, a consultant, a facilitator, a thinking partner, a mentor. And in those situations, I need to have my whole self available.
Mm-hmm. And you told me you're also an introvert. So.
And I'm also an introvert, I know.
So you have to really bring it to the table.
Because I was pretty emotional as a kid. I was hoping that meditation could help me sort of calm that part of me that would get so emotional that it would overwhelm me and mm-hmm. I couldn't do the work I really wanted to mm-hmm. do.
And so you do go over how you can train your mind and brain in the book. You want to say a couple of things about maybe something interesting no one has heard about yet in training the brain? Is there something you learned in writing the book besides a meditation practice or contemplative?
Well, this is a little edgy, so I don't know if
I can. It's Thursday Night Talk, and edgy is the way to go. And we're just about ready to take some calls, so please.
Yeah. Well, and this comes, as I was writing the book, I was not only certainly meditating, but I was also practicing some approaches that I learned from Russell Dellman, who does what he calls embodied life work. So again, this is a little edgy, but it's
that's what we're talking about, Mary. Edge.
That's what we are. Yeah, we are.
Neuroscience, the edge.
So it's the brain is not just in the skull. It is our whole nervous system is really the brain, through which energy.
Did everybody hear that? Okay.
Right. Through which energy and information flow. So it's our whole nervous system.
Isn't that great?
It is.
Sorry.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
I think that's great.
And the enteric nervous system, which is, you know, the gut, which is part of the whole, you know, nervous system, that has 50 million neurons in it. So through the work of Russell Dellman and other predecessors of him, there's a whole practice of embodied listening and embodied speaking. And I describe this in the book. And what I mean by that is listening to ourselves beneath all the chitch, beneath all the beliefs and opinions, beneath all the tried and true things we say and know about and say over and over again ad nauseum, which are about our beliefs and opinions and our ideology and things we think we know. So embodied listening and speaking to me is about listening deeply inside ourselves for what is emerging in the moment when we're talking with other people.
And then working with that.
And then working with that. Now, what that means is we're opening ourselves to not knowing, to being vulnerable. When I'm really speaking from an embodied, well, you can hear it in my voice right now. I'm slowing down. When I try to speak from that embodied place, because the body's wisdom is slower than the brain. It just takes time for it to emerge. So there's a space that opens in that where people can be more learning from one another in the moment, holding their preconceived ideas a little more lightly and letting in some new ideas as they're emerging in the moment based on the interaction in the room. It can be scary for people because they feel the brain loves certainty. So that leads people to want to hang on to their beliefs.
Well, do we have a phone call? No. Oh, you were just talking to somebody in there? Okay. Well, it is 7:26 and 27, so we'll open the phones in just another minute, but feel free to give us a call here if you'd like to ask Mary something or run something by Mary. I think what you're talking about is also, you go over in the book, you know, you get hijacked if you're not aware of these things. And
yeah, emotional hijacking, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which yeah, I think that phrase was coined by Daniel Goleman, who is of emotional intelligence fame. And when people get emotionally hijacked, they lose their awareness. Their perception of what's going on can be skewed. They can feel isolated. Their behavior can be more erratic and impulsive. When we get emotionally hijacked, we lose connection. We don't lose entirely. That's a misnomer. Our ability to connect with the prefrontal cortex, which is right, you know, in the forehead, which is one of the many gifts of that beautiful part of the brain, is our ability to manage impulsive behavior. So when we lose access to it, we lose the ability to actually to make conscious choices about what we're going to say or do. Contemplative practice, interestingly enough, the research shows that it strengthens the connections between the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala, or that mammalian brain, that midbrain, which enables us to then notice and make more conscious choices. So that's one piece. And the other thing I'll quickly add is when we're emotionally hijacked, we also get cognitively hijacked. And what I mean by that is that we can fall more quickly into confirmation bias, meaning we look for information that supports what we already believe. Loss aversion gets stronger, so we want to protect the status quo. It's harder for us to envision sort of the benefits of doing something different. And finally, it gets harder for us to tolerate holding. It's called intolerance of cognitive dissonance is the term for it. But what it means is holding two disparate or conflicting ideas together at the same time. Holding open the possibility that maybe they're both true. You know, I think climate change is caused by human beings. Other people don't. It's like, how can we hold both of those long enough in our conversations that we might consider that there's truth in both of them, some truth in both of them, and that you know, that maybe there's a middle way we can find to approaching solving that issue. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, that's a huge issue, but...
Well, yeah, but it's a good example. What is loss aversion?
Loss aversion means that we are more inclined to protect what we already have than we are inclined to consider the possible benefits. So we feel the loss of something. We can get more upset about, you know, like losing. Barry Evans had a wonderful comment column this week in the North Coast Journal on this. I loved it. It was like, oh, Barry, go. So he uses the example of the upset of, you know, losing our keys. Like we're more upset about losing our keys. That's more distressing to us than the joy of finding them.
Mm.
So that's loss aversion. You know, we can get very, I think our survival instincts get triggered.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I mean, some of the psychologists call it negativity bias. We tend to focus more on what threatens us than mm-hmm. than what resources are available to mm-hmm. us. So it's, to me, it's kind of connected to loss aversion. Mm-hmm. We feel we look for the negative more than we do the mm-hmm.
well,
positive.
And it's been said that there's a stronger feeling associated with that. So people
yes.
tend to enjoy that. Energy.
Yeah.
Without knowing it, you can have the same amount through joy or
yeah.
finding your keys.
Or finding your keys, right. Right. It's more, yeah, exactly, yeah.
And so this is complex because you have so many people at a table with so many different backgrounds. And so where does one start? I mean, where's the best place to start besides your book, which I really do. I'm not just saying that because we're talking tonight, but it's got a lot of amazing information in it. It's called Talk Matters, and it's coming out in August. You'll be able to get it locally at
Blake's, at Northtown.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Blake's in McKinleyville, Northtown in Arcata, and Booklegger in Eureka.
Okay, it's not a picture book. It's got lots of information for you. But so what's the first thing that you recommend?
Being clear on what you're trying to get done. It's just amazing to me how many conversations people just jump into. I mean, if you're just, you know, hanging out, chatting, you know, your Ramones and you're just, you know, having fun chatting, I mean, mm-hmm. that's one thing. But if you're a meeting or at work in your community, without being clear on what is it we're trying to get done here in this meeting or series of meetings, then what it does is open up for, number one, people can feel threatened because there's a lot of uncertainty in that. And there's nothing more uncertain than conversations. You never know what anybody's going to say.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has a different perspective. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's wonderful. However,
is that hysterical?
I mean, I mean, it's
conversation.
Wonderful.
It's frightening.
It's frightening.
Terrifying.
It can be terrifying.
Yeah, sure.
For some.
Yeah.
But my point of advocacy is the clearer we are about what we're trying to get done and what the process is, then people can focus more on the content. And be more, feel safer, feel connected to one another and safer. So they know what the conversation is about. They know what their role is. They know what the decision-making process is. They know, you know, in this meeting, are we going to go from defining the problem to developing solutions and then developing an action plan? Or is this meeting just going to be focused on defining what the issue is? And then the next meeting will, you know. So it's even that is such a simple mm-hmm. agreement. Let's mm-hmm. focus for the next 20 minutes on making sure we understand what the problem is.
Mm-hmm. And you also go over some really great ways to say you're in a meeting and nothing's really happening or there's no agenda. And so there are ways to communicate without being destructive.
Hey.
Have we? Yeah, that's all I ever say. Hey.
I like
are
that.
We?
That's a good opening. Well, my last, the blog that just came out yesterday, actually, it's I can't remember the exact title, but it's something like Being a Prisoner of a Bad Meeting.
Right. So, this is the part in the book.
Yeah,
too.
You don't need to. Yeah, and it's part of the book.
Okay,
you
and
don't
so
need
how,
to be a
give
prisoner
us a few
of
examples
bed.
Of getting not being a prisoner in a meeting.
So it's not my meeting, right? Okay, so let's pretend you're Danielle. You're running this meeting. You've convened us together. Hey, right? And you're just saying, hey, let's all just get together. So I'm sitting in this meeting, and so I say, you know, I don't know exactly what we're talking about. So I ask. So I don't understand why we're here. What's the purpose of this meeting? What are you trying? Well, you know, Danielle, you brought us together. What would you like us to get done in the next 30, 40, 60 minutes? You know, and if you're not clear, then maybe we figure it out together. Mm-hmm. Or I mean, people, it's, you know, I'm just a stickler for beginning meetings
but
on time.
But it's okay to communicate.
So wait,
this is
yeah.
all about communicating for connection and to make things run smoother and to actually get somewhere instead of just going around in circles.
Yes. And there are two reasons that I feel so passionately about the process. Number one is at every level in our country and world, we are facing amazing issues that are scary, they're interconnected, they're complex. To solve them, we need to talk with people who are different from us. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's key to improving our process so that we can solve those issues. Because I really believe in our ability, if we learn better process of better ways to interact with one another, it holds immense promise. I mean, I think we're just at the cutting edge of really understanding, both from brain science, innovative processes, social psychology. I think we're just at the cutting edge of being able to see what might be possible among us, you know, were we to have better process in how we interact with one another.
We have a phone call.
Whoa, great.
And it's, I was going to say we could have a little music, take a minute, but since we have a phone call, Michael from West Haven, please go ahead. We're getting this hooked up. You're listening to Thursday Night Talk, and phones are a little tricky. Got it, Michael? No? Okay. Why don't you call back, Michael, from West Haven? I was talking to Rocaforte there. It's okay. You hang up, and I'm going to help you through this. When the phone rings again, you have to wait till that blinking light goes away. So you push phone, wait till the blinking light goes away. There you go. So just answer. Push phone. It's okay. We're taking time. This is what it's about, right?
Yes.
No panic. No problem.
I love it. No panic, no problem.
No panic, no problem. Hard on the engineer. It's in his maiden voyage. But anyway, so Michael, call back from West Haven if you're so inclined. And we have another caller on the line, too, that's going to be coming through in a minute. So we were at...
I was talking about sort of the big issues and the impact of process.
Mm-hmm.
And the only quick thing I would add to that is process not only affects our ability to think together, learn together, solve issues together, create a desired future together. It also affects how we feel about one another.
Mm-hmm.
So as we see in this country right now, the level of polarization is overwhelming and frightening. So I think it's a time where we either are going to break down or break through.
Yeah, that's the whole point about connectedness being so crucial, that
exactly.
you want to find a way to be connected.
Exactly.
Being connected is finding your keys.
Yeah, yeah.
And we got another call. Crossing our fingers. I might have to go in there and help him out.
Okay.
Let's see, I can ask you another question.
Just a great learning curve for all of us, right? It's fine.
Well, and we all experience and communicate emotions, whether we want to or not, and they start before you're conscious of them, as you say. And,
yes.
So it took you how long to write this book? This is your life's work. Did you, really, it's a doctoral project, a thesis. It's a huge paper.
Well, this
will
crack
be presenting
you up.
My
actual dissertation was on a particular meeting methodology. Mm-hmm. So my dissertation research
is in
was,
here.
That was a really long time ago.
Yeah,
but
Phil from Petrolia is on the line.
I've been pondering the human race and the issues we're faced with in this particular century. It's just absolutely amazing what's going on, and the cognitive dissonance that's going on, and in contrast to the advancement that humans have made technologically, and how backward some of our people are, misinformed they are, who are attempting to be leaders or whatever. And it is my intuitive sense that I think that technology is actually going to perhaps accelerate humans into more civilized behavior. That the data flowing so fast, it's just the beginning of it, mind you, with these cell phones and what's going on, I imagine it will in turn be like a biofeedback to the human race to actually move us forward to survival.
Biofeedback how? What does that mean exactly?
Through the technology that we're using, these cell phones and computers and such, it's phenomenal. I mean, the information that we can access, mm-hmm. the ability to be able to talk to somebody around the globe in a matter of seconds, can only bode better in terms of sending a message. It could be a negative message as well. But nonetheless, I think it may accelerate the human race to be more civilized than it is today.
What do you think about the part where sometimes if you're just all hooked into your phone, you're not talking to the next human being in the room?
When you're hooked into the phone, you're not talking to
other people.
Well, you can if you get on the media. You can talk to a bunch of people pretty quickly. Same thing with Facebook.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, what I like about what you're saying, Phil, is I'm intrigued by the notion of the kind of biofeedback. I mean, I think there's a couple of aspects of that that intrigue me about what you're saying. One is that, I know there are a number of groups, for example, that I connect with on a regular basis where we have conversations, and there are people literally from around the globe. So I feel a connection to them, in Europe, in Africa, and, India, it's just amazing to me. And the technology is when we're having these conversations, I can actually see them.
It's right.
So the interconnectedness of us as human beings on the planet is one aspect of what you're talking about that is really potentially a sign of hope. Mm-hmm. The other aspect, and tell me if I'm hearing you correctly, Phil, is that the mass communication allows us to sort of, I'm not sure we're doing a very good job of it right now, but hear a broader set of messages coming from around the world. What happened with Bernie Sanders, or what is happening with Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, these are people screaming to be heard.
Mm-hmm.
And is that an aspect of how you think about it?
Well, for sure. In other words, the conventional media, the television networks, and the conventional newspapers are being replaced by this instant media, which is able to get other messages through that the conventional media oftentimes censors out. In other words, they have an agenda, which is usually the agenda is making a profit, and anything that threatens that profit, maybe that message is simply not going to reach anybody as much. Whereas the private media or the electronic media can get all kinds of things out without concern for profit.
Yes, unfortunately, sometimes what they get out is not true, though. That's the dark side of it.
Oh, for sure. But I think it is accelerating intelligence. I think in the long run, it's actually accelerating intelligence than it is depreciating it. But for sure, let the buyer beware. You're online, and someone can start some sort of rumor. And yet, it's not true. What's his name? Orson Welles, War of the Worlds, on the radio, was able to motivate so many people. It's unbelievable. unbelievable through that medium, and that can happen also in the electronic medium, especially if you have enough images. For sure, also the reality is that people are learning more through imaging than through words.
Hmm.
You shoot an image across the globe about some cop shooting some black-skinned person or whatever,
yeah.
It's either fabricated or it's true. You know, and so all that also motivates people to react, to respond, to do something about it. So, you know, that idea, I think, can translate into electronic media, and it can't necessarily work through the conventional media. You know, but we're only just beginning. We're only just beginning into this electronic age. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. Waterfalls of data.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
And as with anything, there's a gift and a curse, right? I mean,
right.
You know,
well, the yin and the yang of it, you know, that I mean, I guess that's that's the planet in which we habitate, or the universe in which we habitate, that you have the yin yang of it all.
Right.
But I don't think we can avoid that. Although, what's the term, a singularity? You heard that term, a singularity?
Not sure what you're referring to there.
A singularity is where it doesn't necessarily have a countervailing direction. It's just there. But I'm not familiar enough with it to
Got
know
it. Okay.
The definition of it. But anyway, well, I just think that humankind is not that civilized, but our electronic media, the technology that we've invented, I think may accelerate our civilization to being more civilized.
It is to be fondly wished.
Thank you so much for calling in tonight, Phil.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Thank
well,
you.
Well, and he, you know, brings up something you bring up in the book about, you know, tackling issues, complex issues together. And so I think social media really does. We're all in it together. We're seeing it all at the same time. But I still wonder what you think about, are we interacting as much as we used to with the advent of, you know, smartphones and the quick technology?
You know, I'm not sure that I know. I mean, the things that I worry about, I mean, if I just experience my own day in front of the computer and on my phone and, you know, LinkedIn and Twitter and Facebook, and it's just so much data. Mm-hmm. It's really easy to lose track of a deeper truth, I guess I would say it that way, because there's so much data, so much distraction, which I think quickens our pace.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there's a ton of data, but what about the meaning of that data?
Mm-hmm.
How do we even know what to pay attention to?
Yeah. Well, and that's where that contemplative practice would come in as well. You balance.
Exactly.
Right, and I mean, you certainly putting out a book, you're going to have to do a lot of LinkedIn and Twitter, and you're on the book tour, baby. So you're gonna have to.
yeah. So it's for me discerning. Yeah, it's discerning amidst all of that. You know,
yeah.
What's the deeper meaning here? What is it I'm really after? And it's really bridging differences so we can build a future together.
And Michael is a trooper from West Haven. He called back, and we're going to see if we can get you on the line. Michael, are you there? Michael, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, hi, Michael.
Hey there.
Can you hear him?
Mary's class at Cascadia, and she's just a wonderful gem to have locally, so I really appreciate her. And,
oh, Michael, thank you.
Yeah.
I know who this is.
one thing you started off with was this provocative statement that the public hearing format that we've got right now is counterproductive, and in some ways it's exactly opposite of how we're supposed to be going about things in order to get to what public engagement really should be about. And I'm wondering, what if you had a magic wand and could just change the system, what would that look like for you? One of the things that the Board of Supervisors does that impressed me is they have these budget hearings where it's kind of a workshop format, and they beam all around the county this kind of collective video, and so they're able to patch in people from all around the county and engage them in kind of a less threatening format. I thought that was pretty creative, and I'm wondering, are there other creative solutions you have to that?
Oh, thank you for mentioning that, Michael. Yes, I thought that the whole participatory budgeting, I mean, that's part of a larger movement actually around the world for many municipalities. So I was just thrilled that the county supervisors and, you know, you at the, you, all of you at the county did that. I thought it was just wonderful. I applaud that very much. You know what I've been thinking about, Michael, is the thing I've been wondering about is whether elected bodies like the Board of Supervisors or any elected body, whether they could identify a set of criteria for when they would use a more workshop-style approach to an issue versus the normal public hearing. You know, for example, it might be, you know, the issue is complex. It involves a lot of different stakeholder groups. You know, the stakeholder groups are polarized with one another. You know, there are probably others that I'm not thinking of at this moment. So ideally for me, the elected officials would understand the importance of process, not only for solving the issue at hand, but also for building a sense of community among the people who care about the issue. And from there, then it becomes, instead of a public hearing, it becomes more of a conversation among multiple players at different tables. If, you know, if I think back to the work I did for the Humboldt Bay Municipal Water District, I mean, God, I mean, water is such a controversial issue. You know, how do we protect it and use it in a way that makes sense with the closing of the pulp mills and so on? I mean, we had, you know, to me, that was a great example of following a different path. So we had elected officials and stakeholder advisory group members sitting at tables of four or five, listening to people from the community, you know, around a particular question, you know, around, for example, evaluating various options or what, you know, criteria for decision making about water. And then they would, you know, they would talk for 20 minutes with the elected official or the stakeholder, actually writing down in front of them what people said on a big piece of newsprint at this small table. And then they would change to a different table to talk about something else. So over 400 people participated in that award-winning process. You know, the board of the Water District were stellar. They were so brave to try something new. And what they got out of it was fabulous solutions supported by the community that they're still implementing today. So that, to me, is an example of, you know, if I had a magic wand, it would be helping elected officials, having criteria in place so they can make a decision about when they wanted to go to a more participatory process, and then design it in ways that people talk to one another in more intimate ways. I mean, the feedback that we gathered from that process, the Water District, was just wonderful. I mean, they loved the education. They felt heard by the decision makers. You know, they support what came out of it. They all learned a lot. I mean, it was just, it was lovely. And I'm so grateful to that body of elected leaders, and Carol Riesch, who was the general manager there at the time. Am I responding to your question, Michael?
Yeah, it sounds like what you're advocating is it's a step before the public hearing, where
yes,
people would get together, and then the public hearing itself, you're not doing away with that. You are just transitioning into a public hearing that is more collaborative, is what it sounds like, or has the potential to be more collaborative.
Yes. Yeah.
We have one more call. I appreciate your call, and thanks for calling back today, Michael.
Thanks, Michael.
And, of course, you're available to help any elected official, so you're right.
Yes.
And we've got Tim from Eureka on the line. Tim, are you there? Hi, Tim.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk real quickly about manners. And from what I've seen in the last, 20 to 30 years, the foul language that's used on every day when I ride the bus, you know, and there's little kids on the bus, and people are always using the F word or this or that. And I've just seen, like, the discourse go downhill a little bit, and people don't have any manners. You can see it in the way people drive, and I just don't know. I'd just like you to comment. I don't have any particular thing, but from what I heard from the last caller, too, I thought, you know, there's been so much process involved in trying to solve homelessness, and it's only gotten worse, from what I understand. I could be wrong, but I'd just like you to comment on my observations.
Thanks for calling, Tim.
Yeah.
I'll take it offline.
Okay, great.
Yeah, thank you, Tim. I think you're absolutely right. You know, I think our ability, I mean, just the level of basic civility, you know, your word for it was manners. I think the scales are tilted right now towards individual agendas or polarized group agendas versus thinking about what's the greatest good for the greatest number of us and who gets to decide that. So even though I know that probably sounds like a big concept, I think it goes right down to the individual behavior that somehow I'm more important than my community, or and that I don't understand that my words and behavior have impact for good or ill. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And you can do what you can to improve by not using that language. And
right. Right. Because that language can be so distressing or disrespectful to people. Mm-hmm. I mean, not everybody feels that way, but.
Yeah. Well, we're close to the top of the hour. You've been listening to Thursday Night Talk, and Talk Matters. What's the rest of the title, Mary?
Talk Matters. Saving the World One Word at a Time. And solving complex problems through brain science, contemplative practice, and effective process.
Available in August. And tell listeners who you are. It'll take me longer than it'll take you to run down your amazing credentials. So Dr. Mary Gelinas, and give us your website, too, if you could.
Oh, okay. Yeah, website is www. Did I do the right number of W's?
Yeah, that's fine. Whoa.
GelinasJames.com. So that's GelinasJames, JAMES.com. So there you'll find my blog.
Okay, great.
And then there's the Cascadia Center for Leadership. So you can get that through CascadiaLeadership.org or by going through to the Humboldt Area Foundation website. There's a link there. There's also a link from our website, too. And then finally, there's the Leading Organizational and Community Change, the certificate program that we, Roger James and I, began this year at HSU Extended Ed.
And that's, we could still talk, it was just a little music. But so that's coming up in the fall, and anyone can attend?
Yes. Well, there are three workshops this fall. There are prerequisites for some of the classes, but the ones we're doing this fall are Advanced Meeting Mastery. The second one is Designing Collaborative Processes. Heather Equinos is doing graphic recording, and we also have a class on consulting skills. For those of you who work both as external consultants and internal consultants in organizations like HR people, finance, legal, I mean, you have clients within your own organization, so that class might be really good for you.
Process matters.
Process matters.
Process.
Talk matters.
Talk matters. Saving the world one word at a time. And I really appreciate you writing this book, for one, and for two, joining us here at KHSU on Thursday Night Talk. And I wish you all the very best. Lots of success with the book.
Thank you so much, Danielle. This has been such a pleasure. I really appreciate this opportunity and the chance to be with you.
It was really lovely. I mean that. I really do.
Yes, likewise. Me too.
Michael Roccaforte. Oh, thanks, Michael. Okay, we're out. So, thanks, everybody.
And you have been listening to Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. No room.